Newfoundland. People with courage and foresight have come to mind this rich land for hundreds of years. Now, the next chapter in Newfoundland's mining history is being written. Newfound gold intersected 19 meters at 93 grams per ton, the biggest gold intercept ever recorded in the province. Currently, the company is undertaking one of the most aggressive drill programs in Canada. To learn more, find us online at newfoundgold.ca.
Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodgerix, and joining me today is Lior Gantz. He's the founder of WealthResearchGroup.com, and he's been actively investing since he was 16. How are you today, Lior?
Doing well, and thanks for having me.
Excellent to have you back. I was thinking we could start by talking about how you see the change in the world. Obviously, you've traveled a lot and you get to really make a perspective from having eyes around the world. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you see the change coming out of this virus and that perspective that you have from really seeing it from all parts around the world.
Okay. I think the first thing to keep in mind is the day-to-day life of adults and children. So about 40% of the Western world can work from home. They choose to go to offices, but they can work from home if it came down to it. That's a lot of people. And if that happens, not all of them, not all the 40%, but even half or a third or a quarter of that, we're talking about the biggest migration in human history. For people to stay at home and not to go to the office, it brings a slew of opportunities and a wave of bankruptcies. It's a major change. So that's the one thing that should be on everybody's minds. Are we going into a world where many more millions of people are going to work from home offices, their kitchen tables, you know, whatever else, and then come to an office 2-3 times a week? What will the office space look like? How will children be raised in that kind of environment, etc.? So that's a huge change that's coming. And then obviously, many industries are not coming back the way that they used to for a few years or maybe at all. And then maybe some of them get revolutionized. I can go one by one on many of them, but you're obviously thinking along the same lines as myself in terms of just traveling and airlines and recreation, sports, you know, mass events like festivals, etc. It's so broad that it takes an hour to just go over. And these are huge things that, vaccine or not, are going to change because of habits that are changing right now. So I think this is going to stay with us for a few more years, where the global economy and consumers, governments, corporations, they all try to figure out what is the new reality after all this. And it has nothing to do with the lethality of the pandemic. So I just want to come out of the gate and say that this has nothing to do with how lethal the pandemic is, because it really isn't. It's very contagious and quite not lethal to the bulk of the population. So in my opinion, if governments would have prepared better and would execute better right now, then we would not have to go through a period that's long and that's brutal and that's exhausting mentally. But I think that's where we're going, because there's so much division, not just in the U.S., which is the powerhouse that other countries follow, but also in other parts of the Western world and certainly in the less developed countries. So my answer to you is there will not be a lot of Swedens. And what you saw in Sweden will not happen in most places. Islands have a better shot at containing this early and clearing themselves out, but then they have to think how they accept tourists. And countries that are in Europe, where you can just drive around between countries and there are literally no borders, that it will play out on more of a European Union type event. And then in the United States, I think politics will continue to reign supreme on this. And you will see red states and blue states act differently, as if they're in two different countries. And as an investor, this brings a whole host of opportunities and dangers. So it's a very interesting time, and it's a very challenging time for everyone. But also, if you haven't succeeded, if you want to think about it this way, if your life wasn't going well in the pre-COVID world, you have a ton of opportunities right now to reinvent yourself, because there's so many industries that are struggling and are looking for value and solutions.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more, Lior. Recently, you were speaking about what you were calling the last puke, or talking about a great buying opportunity that we're in right now. So tell us a little bit more about that, please.
Okay. So if you're under the age where you need to start thinking about, is your portfolio fully priced or is it undervalued as a whole? Because obviously when you retire, you want to sell everything when it's fully priced or even in a bubble. And that's when you need to think timing. If you're 55 and above, you really need to think timing, because you don't want to undergo a 35% drop in 16 days like we saw in April. You don't want to expose yourself to that kind of a threat if you rely upon that income to sustain your life. But if you're, you know, 25 to 55, which most people listening to this call might be, every time there's a pullback, which is between 5 and 10%, a correction between 10 and 20, or a bear market with 20 and above, it's a buying opportunity, because the downside in equities is always less than the upside. If you just plot the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, the Dow Jones, whatever major index you have 100 years back, everything was a buying opportunity, because the stock market is a wealth creating machine. And all you need to do is have enough time in there and enough common sense, and you can make 6 to 10% on your money reliably every single year. With that said, in the past 100 years, there have only been 4 calendar years where the return has actually been 8%. So it's like having one hand in hot boiling water, the other hand in ice bucket. But if you average it out, it's lukewarm and nice, right? But on a given calendar year, it's never like that. So it's important to have that in mind. That's why I say you have to know how long you have. If you have 20 years, it doesn't matter that COVID just happened to you that much. If you're 62, it really is a concern. If you had to go through the 35% drop and you exited the markets, then you lost 35% of your, basically of your equity for retirement. So with what I'm saying that it's a buying opportunity, what I mean is this. One, gold has surpassed 2000 an ounce for the first time. It was very healthy and very normal after an all-time high and a very psychologically important all-time high for it to go down by 10 to 15%, which we just did, okay? So it's really important to see this not as a top, but as a buying opportunity. Same thing with silver. Silver has gone from 1199 on the COMEX in the March panic to being the best performing asset of 2020. And now it's pulled back significantly, but it's still within that range of 20 to 26, which is all important, because it traded in a range between 14 an ounce and 20 an ounce for years. Once it broke that, it had a $6 move upwards to 26, and it actually overshot. So in my opinion, it's in a perfect position and a very healthy position. And, you know, to me, it can really surpass that previous all-time high of 50 an ounce during this cycle for a slew of many reasons. But the most important thing to realize is that when you live in a world where $13 to $17 trillion is invested in negative yielding government debt, the bubble is not stocks. The bubble is not precious metals, and the bubble is not real estate. The bubble is bonds. And once even 10 to 20 to 30% of that money goes into other assets, particularly the precious metals, which is a replacement for the safe haven status that bonds offer or perceived to offer, then there's so much upside there. And what I really want to stress is in 2018 in December, Tom, you saw what happens to corporations and households when interest rates go above 2.25% on the Fed's funds rate. The mini bear market, that December 2018 move down by 19.2%, was not because rates were too high for governments. That's really not the case. Most governments can withstand their interest payments and service them for many decades. Obviously, their national debts are unsustainable. So in other words, they don't have a way of carrying down the overall size of the debt, but they can certainly service the interest component of it for many more decades. What brought about this huge problem in December of 2018 that caused that monetary U-turn from Jerome Powell and the Fed is that corporations and households are now very much fixated on this zero interest rate world. They cannot withstand higher rates. and consumer being 71% of the U.S. economy, this is crucial. So I think rates are going to stay very low for a very long time. In fact, what I wrote is that they're actually going to stay negative for as long as this monetary system exists. The only way out of it is a restructure, either a very violent one, so things get out of hand, or a very orderly one where it's just a G20 or a G7 meeting and they decide on a new basket of currencies or a new way to structure debts between them, et cetera, et cetera. And maybe people obviously that hold bonds will lose a lot of principal. So that tells me that there's a buying opportunity both in stocks and in precious metals. And in fact, we wrote since March, Tom, we issued 4 watch lists, wealthresearchgroup.com/list/list2/list3/tech. They each came with a proposed limit order for every company mentioned in them. Every company that got to that limit order is up between 25 and 50%. And so, in my opinion, this is a great time to be an investor and a stock picker. And obviously, it's also a great time to be part of the indices because what are you going to do? The wealth is getting created in innovation and in stocks. And the best way to replace your cash is to put it in precious metals. I see no reason to hold bonds, and certainly not $17 trillion worth of bonds. And these sovereign wealth funds are the pension funds that hold them. So in my opinion, that's the bubble. And that's why everything else is a buying opportunity. Certainly, some of it being much more attractive than other. So there are things that are very much fully priced, and there are other things that are undervalued.
Absolutely, they are. So just to clarify a little bit on how you see gold, you guys wrote a very interesting piece on your website called the Gold Playbook. So tell us a little bit more about what's in there and what that really highlights for people.
Okay. Yeah. So wealthresearchgroup.com/gold playbook is actually a free PDF download report. And it basically goes over the entire world of precious metals and how one should look at it when he wants to invest. And it follows the thesis that I've built for myself. I took 24 months worth of my living expenses. So I calculated my burn rate on a monthly basis for the family unit, and I multiplied it by 2 years, so 24 months, in case there's a 2-year depression. And I converted that cash to physical precious metals between gold and silver. And it's very simple. So if a family unit spends, let's say, $3,000 a month, you multiply that by 24, that's $72,000. You go to the bullion dealer and you purchase a mix of gold and silver eagles. And that is sort of your start over fund, your depression fund. If you have a problem where your income dries up, if you have a problem where things go rough in your life, you have that. And obviously, remember, in a depression, the purchasing power of these metals will actually go up, so it can even last for more than 2 years. That to me is plan B. Okay. And then on top of that, I can invest for gains. I can look at ways to actually capitalize on the boom and bust cycle of the precious metals sector. So you have one segment that's just a purchasing power duffel bag, if you will. And then secondly, you have to think in terms of how can you make money? How can you make gains? There are two things that I look at. One is companies that have been able to defeat gravity and win in spite of the cyclicality of the boom and bust cycle. And those would be the royalty companies. So I love that angle of it because those companies have proven that their business model is great, even in a bear market for the commodity prices. So the report goes through and shows that angle. And then a very small percentage should be considered in equities that are very much leveraged to the price of gold in a bull market. And that is something that you need to know a few strategies. And we wrote about those strategies if you go to wealthresearchgroup.com/bear, because they're actually like bear market strategies. It's 11 strategies on how to build positions in these equities that are the riskiest part of the market, companies that don't have profits or that their profits solely depend on a commodity, which is obviously very risky. And these would be the mining shares. So in the way we look at it, we have not reached a point where these equities as a group are fully valued. And within them, we see a lot of health, a lot of healthy balance sheets, a lot of responsibility from the corporate governance. And a very good indication of this is that a company like Berkshire Hathaway went and bought a position that's worth $500 million in Barrick Gold, reason being for them that it pays a dividend and it can increase that dividend. It has very good market. It's a great business. Right now, it's a great business to be in, especially when you have so many bleeding industries out there. So think about the two things that are most important for mining companies, one being the price of the metal and two being the price to extract that metal. When oil prices are this low, and they will stay low for a very long time, and when the labor component is so attractive because there's so much available people to do the job, you have a situation where you're in sort of a nice pocket here for the mining companies. And then obviously the development stage companies will benefit from all the cash flow and the cash positions of the majors.
So, Lior, as you're speaking about really building that portfolio, so one leg of that stool would be having that duffel bag or savings account, and then the other side of it, having some money set aside for speculative investments. What kinds of companies and or management teams, like how do you look at what you want to buy in that speculative basket?
Okay. So because it's so speculative, I immediately don't want to touch about 99% of the companies. And what I really want to look for are companies where, one, somebody else has done the work and he's already figured out for me that this could be a very attractive opportunity. So I look at basically the 10 to 20 people that are seriously successful in this business and what are they investing in. Now, these people also have a spray and pray mentality, so they can be invested in like 200 companies, Peter Lynch style, where, you know, some of them will be tambeggers, and the ones that don't, they just popped out of at a 20% loss, and it evens out to be an exceptional overall return. And some of them are very strategic. They only invest in a few, and they go all in. So what I look for are these types of plays. If I see names that I trust in a company, that is a preliminary reason for me to look further into it. So that's one. The second thing I look for specifically in a mining company right now are people that have done exits. In other words, people that know how to sell companies and know all about the science of getting an institution to buy an asset from them. Because those people, they have an appreciation of the time clock. They wake up in the morning knowing, I don't know how long this bull market lasts, so I need to de-risk this project in order to make it attractive for a major to purchase it. If I get into a situation where I can't do that and I have to live through another cycle, this will be brutal for shareholders, brutal for myself, you know, is what a CEO would be thinking. So I look at management teams that have had success in the past at either selling companies or were involved in the sale of a company, not as the leading CEO of that company, but they were part of a team, and therefore they have the experience and they know what's going on behind the scenes to get a deal done. So that's second. And the third thing I really like is some proof of concept. I treat companies that are gold companies but don't have any gold, in other words, they're just exploration, I don't want to invest in them. To me, these should be private ventures. They shouldn't be even publicly traded. They should just be, you know, private in the hands of venture capitalists that want to take on huge risks for huge rewards. But if you already have a proven idea of your business model, you know what you need to do, and you have people that back you that are very strategic to you, so they're not only shareholders, but they're also mentors, and you have the right jurisdiction, then you have something that if it has merit to be advanced in the next 2 to 3 to 4 years, because you just don't know how long this lasts, you have an opportunity in your hands to make a lot of money. And obviously, looking at previous cycles, you have all the proof of concept that you want. Companies can go up tenfold, 20-fold, 30-fold, etc. But it's all about being patient and staying the length. But if you do that, then that's very important. Recently, I've looked at a company called Newfound Gold, for example. Biggest backers, Eric Sprott and Rob McEwen, actually a third backer, went in through his entity, Nova Resources, but actually the leading person in Nova Resources is a very important geologist who has a lot of information and a lot of experience in finding mega deposits. And so when I saw that combination of three, plus you have a very experienced management team, then we really like Newfound, and we're actually in a relationship with them and a very good partnership with them.
Interestingly, so as you're talking about this kind of 3 to 5 year time frame, where do you see the price of gold and silver heading in that time?
Sure. And it's also important to remember with companies like Newfound Gold and other companies that we work with them, furthering their public awareness and making sure that people understand and know them. That's what Wealth Research Group is built for. And with regards to silver and gold, here's my take on this. Gold has never had a bull market where 1971 till 1980, it was 2,400% return, 24 times your money. Between 2000 and 2011, it was 6 times your money, or just about 6 to 7 times your money. In my opinion, gold did not have a bear market that is deep this time around between 2011 and 2015. Throughout that period, there was a lot of bid for it. Therefore, I don't expect it to do a 24 to 1 or a 6 to 1, but I do expect it from that low of 1,052 an ounce in December 15 of 2015, I do expect it to return between 3 and 4 times in real terms. In other words, in my opinion, gold could still be a double from here. With that said, if you have an entire industry that's working on about $1,200 an ounce all-in sustaining cost, at $3,000, this is one of the best industry. This is like a tech company. This is like a software company. You can make margins that are plus 150. These are huge gains. So if this happens, this is a industry that you definitely want to be in. In terms of silver, I think what's really important is to see it in context of what it is. Silver for 20% of its buyers is an investment. For 50% of its buyers, it's an industrial metal. And then you have other uses like jewelry, etc. It's those 20% that invest in it for protection, for inflation, etc., that determine the price. Obviously, all the industrial buyers want it as cheap as possible, so they will not determine the price. But Tom, I ask you, if you are working on a fixed income salary and now you think inflation is coming and you go to the bullion dealer and you have $250 to invest with the bullion dealer, and he tells you silver is 30 an ounce, or silver is 40 an ounce, or silver is 50 an ounce. You already put gasoline in your car. You already drove to the bullion dealer. You already committed to it. Do you think it will matter to somebody with $250 if silver is 30, 40, or 50? To them, it would mean the same thing. It would be the same as getting a bill in the restaurant for $30 or $40. It's not a deal breaker. You'll still go and eat. And that's what I'm saying about silver. Silver to me can be 30, 40, or 50. In case of fears of inflation, if that really happens like there was in 2011, I see no difference for the average person if he already decided, if he's already mentally and emotionally invested in silver. He wants silver. He wants to have some bullion in his hands. I don't think he will mind the difference between 30, 40, and 50 because the average order is not, you know, $50,000 or $100,000, this is not the average buyer. The person who will determine the price is the person who wants a few ounces and is just willing to pay more for them. That's what happened in 2011. That's what will happen right now. That's what happened in the Hunt Brothers, where people were lined up around the corner to buy bullion. That's what's going to determine this. And that's why I think Eric Sprott and other people are saying, hey, this could be $100, because it can be. It's so much cheaper than going and getting gold. And for the average person, there is no difference. What is the difference for you if you have ounces of gold or ounces of silver? It's not like you're going to clear a room in your house for all of it. You're just buying a few of them.
Absolutely, Lior. And it really does seem that once that retail component really starts to rush in and buy the, as some people say, the poor man's gold, that could really start to accelerate the price of silver, correct?
Yes, 100%. The main reason that people go out and purchase silver is they see weakness in the dollar, and then they get exposed to some information online through a friend or somewhere else that reinforces that feeling that they already had. So that, coupled with some distrust of authorities, is the blend, that three-part blend that makes people go out and purchase silver.
Interesting. So, Lior, before the call, you and I were talking a little bit about the millennials' purchasing power, and they represent basically 25% of the U.S. population right now, and they're not able to live the type of life that their parents did. You have a very interesting take on this segment of the population. So what is the change that we could see from the millennials coming into the next couple of years here?
Sure. And I think this part of the interview will get you the most hate mail because I have a very contrarian outlook on this.
Absolutely. And that's why I wanted to ask you about it.
Okay. People are underestimating the growth in purchasing power of the millennials. Right now, 60% of America's purchasing power comes from the baby boomers, while about 4% comes from the millennials. So just think about that. A quarter of the population, 4% of the purchasing power. That's insane. The reason for it, obviously, being that in today's world, in the 21st century, if you live in America and you're between the ages of 20 and 30, you have a starting job. This is not like in the baby boom miracle of the 50s and 60s, where 20-year-olds were needed in middle-income jobs. Just there was so much industry and so much growth coming in that any person straight out of college or straight out of high school would get a great job and would basically be able to sustain a family with one income. These are not these days. And therefore, it took another decade for the millennials to hit the time that they can start heading out of their parents' house, start thinking about families. Most of them have not formed families. Most of them are now entering pre-earning years. And you have to realize that you're going to have a lot of them. Most of them are also college grads, which means that their median income is about 30K a year higher than their parents on average. So think about this and then think, okay, I have 85 million people that are entering their 30s. They will leave their parents' house. It will not stay this way. They will buy homes. They will form families, which means that they have to originate mortgages. They have to go to, you know, Home Depot and wherever else and buy everything for the house. They have to do all of that. And that is what created the bull market in the 80s and 90s when the boomers did that. If I can put you into that frame of mind, the boomers were born in the 40s and 50s. Then what happens in the 40s and 50s? You know, baby food and diapers were the biggest companies to grow. Then they became teens. What happens when they became teens? McDonald's, fast food, everything that has to do with Playboy and everything the teens are involved with erupted. Then they went into college years. In their college years in the 70s in Europe, they couldn't find enough space in universities. People were studying in theater halls because there was just not enough space for universities. And then in the 80s, they entered the labor market and started buying homes. You saw a boom in homes and in the stock market in the 1990s. They had a lot of money, a lot of free money. You saw what happened when they had excess amounts of money. And then in the 2000s, the boomers started thinking about wellness, and you saw a wellness revolution that is going on for 20 years now. So they created a huge surge of wealth that if you followed it, you made a fortune. That's what actually what Warren Buffett did. He followed them through their years, and that's how he invested throughout this period. Now you have a new generation that's going to obviously close the gap. And then you also have to think inheritance and otherwise, because that money is going to come by definition to that generation. Because every 10 seconds that I speak, a person celebrates his 65th birthday in the United States. You also have to think that everything I just said about 80 million Americans is true for China, which has a national agenda, a mission to get their middle class from 10K a year to 15K a year. Think about it in terms of percentages. They want to increase the wealth of their middle class by 50%. If that happens in America right now, every family would earn every generation another $250,000 after taxes. That's an insane amount of money. And so the growth in the United States is about 2% right now, and the population growth is 1%. So that means every generation gets an additional $25,000 to $30,000 in their pocket worth of GDP. That's nothing compared to what China is doing. So all of this millennials are also in China. And the entire picture here is that there's going to be a surge in housing demand, a surge in everything that has to do with starting a family. And all of this is important for velocity of money, which we have not had in the United States for 20 years. We've just not had a situation where there's organic demand for anything. The boomers were, in the last 20 years, downsizing, liquidating, selling their big houses, moving to smaller houses. You know, they don't need new cars. They don't need vacations as much as they did when they were younger. And that's why you saw a lot of deflation in the United States in the past 20 years. This is sort of the bottom years for this, because as the millennials start to increase in wealth, and they will, because they're entering and they're inheriting great jobs from the boomers that are retiring, you will see velocity of money pick up. How much will it pick up? Well, think in terms of there's zero interest rates right now. Let's say that they're 1% or 1.5%. Inflation can be 3.5 to 4% on the official, on the government CPI. So we can be in a situation where for the next decade, we have real rates that are negative. That is huge for gold and silver. That is huge for equities. And that is very bad for savers that are just trying to sit there and collect a bond, which nominally is killing you. So very important. That's at least my take through the years and years that I've looked into this subject.
Interesting, Lior. One of the other things that I wanted to ask you about is what you think the risks are for the US dollar basically losing its reserve currency status going forward in this new era.
Okay. Obviously, the $128 million question even more, maybe. So the thing is this, there is no other country that can serve that role. Okay. So think about it like a very dysfunctional marriage that divorce seems even worse. And that's why all countries still use the US dollar, or 60% of transactions are done in the US dollar, because there is no other currency to fill that gap. And nobody trusts China, and it will never be a reserve currency. The yuan will not be in a reserve currency. What you might have are two types of solutions. If China and the United States can't agree on anything, in other words, they can't come to terms, they can't be civil, they can't create a world where there's two superpowers, then you will have two blocks of currencies. You will have the Western block of currencies, which will be United States, Canada, Europe, etc., that will deal more in the dollar or be more dollar-centered. And then you will have China and its countries that it's towing through the world, like Australia, or maybe Australia will be with the West. It doesn't really matter. The idea is two blocks. Obviously, China will be with Russia, and India can be in that mix, and perhaps Africa. And that's one solution. You have two blocks. Then you don't need everyone to agree, because you have two blocks and some sort of an exchange mechanism between them. The more likely solution will come from the free markets, and then will be adopted later on by governments. So in that kind of world, you will have innovation coming into the world of currencies, and we're already seeing it. We're basically living inside of a lot of innovation in fintech, and I think that's where the world is going. It's going towards a world where it doesn't really matter what your national currency is, because there are so many national currencies that are just not dependable. And with technology so easy and so available, many of these countries that have shitty fiat currencies can just skip the step that they have to do to fix their currency. They won't need to fix their currencies. Their entire economy can be on other currencies. And that's what I think the progress will come from. The emerging world, India and a lot of parts of Africa, and obviously China, they can really step over or leapfrog what's happening in Europe and the United States and move on to the next stage. I don't know if you know this, but in China, for example, they don't use cash for the most part, and they don't even use credit cards. They have an app called WeChat. Within the WeChat, they can pay. And even if you go to a market, like an outdoor market, like a bazaar, like a street food, and you want to buy vegetables from a lady that's 90 years old, she will still use that app. That's how much it's already adopted into their culture and into their way of life. So just think of that. And know that for the most part, what the dollar will have to concede to is that innovation is going to make it so that it becomes less important to deal with the reserve currency of a country and more with a very simple and reliable currency or basket of currencies that everyone agrees on.
Excellent, Lior. Is there any other thoughts that you'd like to share with us as we wrap up here?
I think one of the most important things is that everything we've discussed has to do with your investments. And for most people, for 9 out of 10, their investment portfolio is a secondary engine in their lives, with the main engine being their careers. So if you can spend much more time thinking about how you can advance either your business or your career, you would have a much greater return on your time spent. The best way I can put it is this. If you invest in index funds, you will make 6 to 10% a year. If you happen to find a genius hedge fund manager that you can invest with, you can make upwards of 10%, between 10 and 15%. If you find the one person in this world that can return more than 15%, then you can be a millionaire. And that's what the people that saw and found Warren Buffett early did. He changed the lives of families within his scope, his neighborhood, his city, etc. But if you're not one of those lucky people, then you have to realize that with 6 to 10% a year, this is a 30 to 40 year game for you. Just keep investing, keep buying equities, keep having more exposure to companies, to real estate, etc. But have most of your time spent on your career, because that's where you can double and triple and quadruple your worth in a year's or 2 years or 3 years time and get paid what you're worth. And that's where you can have a fantastic life in building a great career or a great business.
Perfect. Share a little bit about where we can find more information from you, Lior.
WealthResearchGroup.com is the website. It's also a free financial newsletter where I share what's going on in my own life and also opportunities when it comes to the stock market.
Excellent. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, sir.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.
Think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw material. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?